title of this session is, Unexposed, Co-Creating New Models for Care, Community, Wellness, and Dignity. So what does that mean? I think that's kind of up to us as a group. We're going to be discussing these kinds of problems and questions, so maybe by the end of this session, we'll kind of have an idea and answer to that question. But the goal for today's chat, from the OAA's perspective, was to have a discussion about long-term care and how that relates to the facilities themselves, the experiences of the users and the staff, and also the regulations and the policies, the decisions that get made at the top and end up affecting us as architects and how we work, and ultimately the people that really live in those buildings. So the format of this session, as mentioned, we'll get the ball rolling up here with a few questions, and then we'll have a little breakout session where you can get into some small groups, discuss some questions that we'll provide, and then we'll come back as a group and discuss those together. So just to make sure everyone is awake and ready to go here, with a show of hands, who has worked on a long-term care facility or a retirement home, nursing home in their professional career? Just out of curiosity. Quite a few, actually. Okay, that's probably about half the audience. And then another show of hands, how many people here have at least spent time in a long-term care facility, visiting friends, families, visiting grandma, that kind of thing? Okay, almost everyone. And who here plans on spending a portion of their life living in a nursing home? No one, okay. That's a trick question, because that should be basically everyone here, right? And as a follow-up to that, then assuming everyone here does have to spend some time in a long care facility, with a show of hands, who is excited about living in a nursing home? One person. One. He likes playing bridge, I bet. So that just kind of paints a picture. It's an important topic because it really does affect everyone. We're all going to essentially live in a long-term care facility at some point, fingers crossed. But no one is excited about it, right? So there's obviously some room for improvement, some serious room for improvement. And luckily, we're joined by four experts here today. So let me introduce our guests. So we have Dr. Terry Peters. She's an assistant professor at the Toronto Metropolitan University, Department of Architectural Science, where she teaches and supervises graduate students in both the architecture and building science programs. Dr. Peters is a registered architect in the UK. She holds a WELL AP designation and is a member of the 2021 WELL Concept Advisory for Lighting. Her current research focuses on building performance in health environments, pre- and post-occupancy evaluations, and the intersections between architectural quality and inhabitant quality of life in long-term care homes. She's an affiliated researcher at the Institut de Savoir Montfort in Ottawa, pardon my French, and she's authored and edited numerous publications, including more than 20 peer-reviewed publications about sustainable housing, and she was part of the jury for the OAA's Shift 2023 Health and Architecture Challenge. We also have Dr. Tamara Daly, who is a feminist political economist and health services researcher and professor at York University. She's the director of the York University Center for Aging Research and Education and the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council Partnership for Age-Friendly Communities. Her research focuses on gender, health access and outcomes, improving conditions in long-term residential care, and promoting policies for health equity for older adults and their caregivers. She's authored more than 100 publications and received numerous awards, including the Faculty of Health Dean's Research Award, the Canadian Institutes of Health Research and Mental Health Commission of Canada People's Choice Award. Next, we have Mike Laddick. He's a partner here at a local studio, Third Line Studio in Sudbury, where he's worked since 1995. Over his 22-year career, Mike has successfully completed numerous projects across a range of sectors, including commercial, industrial, institutional, First Nations, and residential. Notably, Mike was involved in the redesign of the Wikwemekong Elders Lodge on Manitoulin Island, where he worked closely with the Wikwemekong First Nation to create a culturally appropriate design that addressed the community's needs. In addition to his professional work, Mike is also an active member of several local boards, reflecting a commitment to the community here in Sudbury. And we also have Nicole Pierce. She's an architect and a graduate of the University of Waterloo's architecture program. She previously worked at HOK and KWC Architects on large-scale public renovation projects. In 2010, she founded the design firm Architecture NC to foster collaboration and communication between clients and contractors. Nicole's personal experience as a caregiver for her parents led her to focus on creating environments of care and proposing a new person-centered architecture that empowers architects to speak for the value of architecture and the spaces of people's lives. So to kick things off and kind of frame this discussion, I thought it was important to kind of start with some broader themes in terms of long-term care. So the first point here that I wanted to bring up was, what should we all expect ourselves and for other people when dealing with the final stages of life? Like, what values and priorities are important when considering long-term care? Who wants to jump in first?
I think this is on. Can everybody hear me okay? I think one of the comments that we were just talking about before the conference here started was, and it's just really a statement, long-term care isn't a place to go and die. Long-term care is a place to go and live. So how do we do that, right? And you know, we started talking about that, and it just kind of spurred on a whole lot of discussion. And it's interesting when you start looking at that, because we oftentimes put ourselves, or should be putting ourselves, in our own buildings. And I know that sounds strange in a way, but what we found over the past is that, you know, buildings are designed without any real consequence to the end user or any regard for the end user. So in the case of Wequimacong, for example, we've had a variety of consultations. We meet every 2 weeks, and it's been awesome. We just, unfortunately, they had an incident in the community yesterday. We were supposed to have a consultation with the actual community. But we had one recently, which was quite, it was eye-opening in a lot of ways. We actually did a consultation with the residents. We had in the dining room, and I'm not sure if a lot of you are familiar working with First Nations, but First Nations, sometimes you can have people as young as 45 in a long-term care facility. So it's not just for 80-year-olds, and we have this stigma with people with problems and things like that. That's not actually true. So it was really engaging, and we had a lot of really good discussion and a lot of good takeaways from that informed the design process. And the process itself has been really good because we've been able to take some time to go through it. It hasn't been a rush. We started the feasibility study, I think, in 2017. So we've done a lot of work with the community over the years. The pandemic put a little bit of a sidebar to it, but a lot of good things. Things like, you know, there was this one incident, it was kind of funny, not funny, but we started talking about the landscape plan for the project and where the facility was going to be, and of course the orientation and the cardinal points and things like that. But a lot of the residents in Wequimacong is pretty dynamic. They actually had this outdoor performance, but they really have nowhere to do that at the nursing home. So they did it in the parking lot right out front of the nursing home. So they had a live band, and they had, it was rock and roll, it was pretty cool. And I saw the video, and it was amazing. So they had all the residents out there in this parking lot. And people would be walking by on a sidewalk, and those people would come in, and they'd join the barbecue, they listen to the music and things like that. And everybody that we were talking with in that room couldn't stop talking about that. It was engagement. It was life. It was being a part of the community. Another portion of that was the location of the building, for example. Sorry, I'm rambling here a little bit, but you know, a lot of the people said, well, how come you didn't locate it with a big view? Well, you talk to the residents, they don't want a big view. They want to be engaged. They want to be in the community. I think we had about 10 or 15 different comments that loved the fact that I could walk to the hardware store. Because some of them, again, they're not bedridden. They're living. They need a place to live. So a lot of this is also some form of social housing as well. But that's kind of where we started. So I don't want to take up all the mic time.
I think it's important to consider the long-term
care as a place that's part of the community. So often it's walled off from what other people in the community are doing. And it's not a place that's seen as terribly accessible. One of the things that we were talking about is the way in which the ministry regulations stipulate what has to be locked, who can access what, and there's certain good reasons for some of that. But I've been to long-term care homes around the world, and not everybody thinks about long-term care the way we do in Ontario. And in particular, lots of places, and I'm thinking about Norway here in particular, they see the long-term care home as a place to bring the community. So the library is co-located with the long-term care home. The local pool, the gym, a place for young children to come and practice their ballet lessons, and kids come for their clubs. There's always constant movement in and out. One of the things that we learned as well is we tend to think of giving people very, very nice views and lovely views. Your conversation about the parking lot reminds me that in some long-term care homes, the most popular rooms are the ones that overlook the parking lot. And there's a good reason for that. It's because people go there to live, and they also want to see other people living. So people coming and going into the long-term care is one of the most, the best views that you can have in the facility. And the last thing that I would say is, not only is it a place for living, but it should also be a place for joy. So dignity, yes, but also joy and flexibility. So this idea of using the parking lot, there's lots of ways that we should be thinking about being able to flexibly use space so that it can be creative.
I support everything you guys have said. My mom had Alzheimer's, so we didn't actually use long-term care for very long. We tried it for a few months. So she's one of these needs-based residents. But I think that what I saw, and this includes the people who are working there, we're entrusting them with this huge burden and responsibility, but we don't recognize their humanity in the process. When you're coming to your third job for the day, you need to be able to have a space for yourself to recuperate and recover before you engage in supporting the needs of the people that are there. And we don't think in terms of the people. We don't really seem to understand what the needs are either. I think partly because we're trusting that others are giving us that information, that they understand what the needs are, and you get handed a program, and what we're really doing is relying on them to say that their resource management problem or their scheduling problem is the most important thing, and they're using a spatial relationship to solve it, but that really is our expertise. We should take back that role where we understand people's needs and their relationship to their environment, and when something is not working, we understand how that environment can shift or change or respond in order to support their needs. One of the legacies of person-centered learning was person-centered care, which recognized that behaviors and issues, like you were saying, wandering, and so policy says lock it off. But that comes about because of an environmental condition. And if we understand the needs that are at the heart of that, the need for a sense of safety, a sense of belonging, then we can actually provide those options. Instead of thinking of function, we can think of the activity at the center. You know, like a meal is about nourishment and pleasure and connection, but you get a functional program that says, design a multi-purpose space because, and I'm paraphrasing what I've heard, I have $9 a day to feed these people and I only have this much staff, so I gotta wheel them in twice a day, and if they eat, that's great. If they don't, that's too bad. And that is a baked-in understanding of people's needs and movements that even if you design the most beautiful multi-purpose space, it's not gonna provide the activity at the center, which is nourishment to most of those residents. So when we talk about dignity, we're really saying, what do you expect at the end of your life? I expect to be treated like a human being with human needs, the need to belong, the need to have meaning, the need to have relationships, and how can we actually nourish that and nurture it through our response to that. We do have a place. We are very necessary. Even recently, I was in a hospital and I took a picture of the signs there, you know, no abuse is tolerated. Because when you see those signs, that's a sign that failed, that space has failed, right? Because it's it's nurturing the wrong behavior from us. It's nurturing dehumanization, dissociation. There were signs that said, we see you, you're on camera, go this way with arrows. You know, these are signs that tell us that we're not actually considered in that space. But the women who gave me permission to take the pictures were so relieved to feel like someone saw that what they were enduring working there was also not okay. And I think for us as architects, we need to believe in the significance and necessity of architecture in the well-being of people's lives, because if we're not speaking for it, then who do you imagine is actually going to do that, right? So that's...
Building on these points, it's also designing spaces that we want to visit. Seems like everyone in the audience has visited someone in long-term care, or been in that role where you're trying to socialize there. Maybe you're trying to bring little kids there, or you're trying to talk to and visit with the person that's living there. We often don't design those spaces as places that people would want to visit. So maybe the long-term care home isn't in a location that's convenient. Maybe it is sort of not connecting well with the street and the kind of environment. So co-locating it is such a wonderful idea. And I agree, there are many examples from around the world. Also thinking of several projects in Chicago that have a library co-located with seniors housing, and I believe also long-term care. But I think bringing more the building into the community, and I think that must be frustrating for architects who put up their hands that they're working in this type of project where you don't get to choose the location. You don't get to choose the connection with the community. So how can you design a building that will somehow make those connections or improve the connectivity of the building to the community so that it's somewhere we want to visit, so that somewhere we want to take our kids, or could we come by with the dog, or is there any way we can connect to people, walk around the grounds, go for a walk, sit by the fountain, connecting to other people?
It's also about size. So there's this emphasis on making sure that the units are bigger and bigger. And in fact, the most home-like environments tend to have fewer residents who are located around a space that's akin to a great room. And in some of the best places where I've been, there are long wooden tables that people might gather to eat. In Germany, in the one home I'm thinking of, there were big bowls of fruit and big pitchers of water everywhere. You'd never see that in an Ontario long-term care home. I've seen it in Nova Scotia as well. So there's different models. Sometimes these are referred to as household models. But it's a place that is more comforting, and residents naturally want to congregate in these spaces. It then becomes more, there's a kitchen generally associated with it, so it enables dining that is more akin to people's natural flows. As people age, the time that they're awake and tired is different. Some people need to sleep quite late in the morning, so being able to prepare small meals in a kitchen that is on the unit makes their lives toward the end much more pleasant, and it enables them to be able to not be forced to get up and to get into the dining room quickly. So part of reimagining how we do long-term care is about thinking about how the space could be one where it's possible for people to come together and to actually want to spend time together, so it's not alienating in that way.
Sorry, I was just going to say, Nicole, you mentioned policy, and I think that's an important thing to bring up, and how that relates to these decisions that are made at the top, and it all trickles down, and then trying to reconcile that with humanizing these people. So how do we bring those two together, bridge that gap?
That's a tough one. it's
that slow oil tanker moving in the sea, right? And I think it can happen, you know, with every little... So we're very fortunate right now. So we're partnered with Snyder Architects out of Toronto, working closely with Rochelle and Doug. And I think Doug is one of those champions that have been slowly breaking down that long-term care model. He calls it the lodge model, and we've kind of adopted that in a lot of our work. working with them. So we've got a 96-bed. Get to back to that in a minute, though, Ryan. I've got a full circle here. Mm-hmm. But, so we've got a 96-bed facility that's broken down into three wings of 32, that's broken down again into six wings of 16. And each one of those wings doesn't have a big, long corridor that, you know, it's a bowling alley under the end. It's got a unique sort of set of private rooms, a center core that you can walk around with a lounge at the end, an activity space, a small home kitchen, and a dining facility for 16. So the facility has a main kitchen. We tried to break that down further and actually have three different kitchens in these pods of 32. We didn't get that far, so coming back to policy, it pushed the envelope a little bit too hard. And some of that's with the operators too. So it's not just the ministry and the regulations, it's the operators' facility and how they see their operations working. And most of them want a central kitchen so that food is prepared. And so what we were able to do is take that central kitchen and at least break it down into three surgeries and then home kitchens. And the home kitchens are open 24/7. So someone can come out, and if you're there with your mom or your dad or whoever, you can actually go, you can make a toast, you can make a coffee. You can actually boil cedar leaves and do home medicine if you wish, those types of models. So when you get back to the question about, I forget the question, right?
Trying to bridge that gap between policy and the users, the people that are working there and staying there, and how do we bridge that gap?
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is. I just... maybe one of you do, I don't know. But I think we have to start, right? We have to start that conversation. And it's not just acceptable to sit in your office and whine and complain that the ministry won't do this and the ministry won't do that. They're a part of the solution, right? They're a part of the solution. And they want to hear from us. They do. We've had great conversations with the ministry in a lot of different ways, and even the operators, and we managed to push the envelope a little bit. Would you consider this? And maybe we're fortunate to have good people on both sides of the fence, but they're open to those ideas, right? I think there's a fundamental shift that's occurring out there that we are a part of and we should be a part of, because I think it was stated earlier, we're all going to be in one of those places at some point in our lives. So how do we make it so that it's an enjoyable place to leave? And when you talk about security and things like that, it's only there because people want to leave, right? They want to get out because it's not a home or a lodge, depending on what you want to call it. So I think in terms of policy, we have to have those conversations. Has anybody sent an email to the ministry? You know, we've got a group of architects here. And, you know, is there anything wrong with sharing our ideas? You know, there's that protectionist side of, oh, I got this great idea, I don't want to share it with anybody. Well, what if we had a contingent that went to the ministry and said, look, we've got some great ideas, what do you think? Right? Not just because you got a project, but because you have time and you want to go out and change a bit of the world, piece by piece. So
the tricky bit is that there are standards and then there are policies that relate to how people live and work in long-term care, and the two don't necessarily meet. And I think it's in the gap between those kinds of regs and these regs over here and these regs over here that you don't get the proper conversations happening. And it's probably that we need to do a better job pushing the standards and not seeing the standards as a ceiling, but seeing them as a floor when it comes to design. The tricky bit there, again, is always money and time. But perhaps it's also about shifting conversations with people in Ontario so that we care more about older people, that we release ourselves from some of our ageist ideals about what it is to grow old and what it is people deserve at the end of their lives. And if we can open up those kinds of conversations, we would all want to hope that long-term care is the best that it can be, not the bare minimum. And I think in some communities, they do this beautifully. They see these places as a major employer for the community, so they want it to be a place of decent work, and they want it to be a place of good care. They're caring for their neighbors. They're caring for their family members. They want these to be nice places for people to live in.
I think, too, you're not going to change policy unless we're at the table earlier in the discussion. So to do that, we need to be more educated ourselves about what the people at the center need, not just the people living there, but working there, and understand that. I'm going to pull a mic. I'm going to take a very short detour, but it's actually a really short anecdote about another architect, and I don't know his name, but he was working out of Hamilton, maybe Toronto in the 70s. And there was an article, so the story goes, published about his process when working with clients. So his process, it was a bold choice. He would go and live with his clients as a way to really understand what they needed and observe their movements and their interactions. And when he had a sense of what their struggles were and what their needs were, he would withdraw and design a house that responded to those needs, but also celebrated who they were. And the person who told me the story was not an architect. She was a teacher and a social worker, and later a mental health worker. So she believed in service to well-being. And this story really captivated her imagination, because she also saw a profession of service that, on the one hand, really sought to know people in a fundamental way with their relationship, with their environment, right? Our behavior is essentially, in a simple way, is that relationship made manifest. And where the relationship was struggling, the gift, the response, was one of beauty that not only in a useful way solved or served those needs, but actually nourished their humanity, you know, and all of the parts of us that go into that. And that person was my mom, so she infected my head with this idea. But I think that as architects, we really need to figure out a way to push our knowledge of what the human needs at the center are, and then offer this sort of inhabitable art, right, that is part of everybody's daily experience. It's a medium as well as an environment. And we need to be part of those discussions at the policy table, because we see those interactions in a way that people who are making policy don't. That's not their expertise, right? So we need to be educated, but we also need to be vocal and involved. Because I think you were saying with the parking lot, it's wonderful to think of a destination, right? And within the home to design for destination as opposed to space efficiencies, right? which are necessary. I mean, these are problems, resource managements are problems we need to solve, but not at the expense of the human problem, right? I mean, what is our role if it's not to design for the well-being of the people who are experiencing the spaces? And that's generally speaking, right? I mean, maybe you can think for yourself, if our role isn't to sort of serve humanity, and by that I also mean the environment and the earth and how we treat each other, then what is our role? Because we need to be playing a louder part and a more vocal one in shaping how these things are decided. But it also starts with us, not just our own regulations and our own policies, but getting to the table of pushing on those policies, I think. So
I've heard a couple instances then of some of the successful projects kind of instituting some feedback loops, and you're getting some feedback from the people living there and working there. So how do we foster that so that we're learning from these projects, and then how do we share that with other architects?
I think having more, we don't often do getting that feedback from buildings. Like something that happened during COVID is there was a lot more attention placed on long-term care. A lot of people thought, oh, that's what they look like inside. You know, we're seeing images, we're hearing about things like, you know, the brief banning of window visits. You think, oh my goodness, you know, we can't even visit people through the window. So how is this working? I think the connection between really understanding what we have in Ontario for long-term care, like you mentioned, we're all going to live in one of these someday. Well, we're not. There's not nearly enough beds, like, obviously, right? Even if we started building right this moment as many as we could, there isn't enough beds for everybody. But also, how can we start to reflect things that architects believe is important in these policies and in these guidelines for design, and then how can we check that we're doing what we think we're doing? So I think post-occupancy evaluation, actually formally evaluating buildings after they're built, see if they meet our needs and share those. And I know there's a ton of reasons why people don't want to do that. But I think that's how we can bring more quality to our buildings, is to actually go back and talk to people, have a look. Did it work like we thought? Was the smaller unit size successful? Did staff like it? What if we find that these are successful and that we have some evidence to support our good design ideas?
Building on that, standards can sometimes become standardization, and that is the death knell for creativity and for also reflecting the needs of a particular community. And so this deep consultation that you're doing with the Indigenous community is what every community should be doing when thinking about long-term care. And my favorite examples, when I think about places around the world, deeply reflect the needs of their particular community. And I have to tell you, one thing that drives me absolutely crazy when I go into places, in particular on the locked units, because I spend a lot of time observing on the locked units, but they've got outdoor spaces that have been built in and no one can access the outdoor space, so that people, even on the most beautiful day, are stuck inside. So my favorite homes, in fact, have thought deeply about how to enable people to use the outdoor spaces almost seamlessly with the indoor space. So in a building in Toronto, the locked unit is on the top floor, and it's a walled indoor garden. But as people approach it, people with very serious dementia, as they approach the door, it opens, and they walk out, and they do their loop, and it opens again, and they walk back in. So they're out in this beautiful space, and it's covered, and it's safe. In another long-term care in Ontario, they've used the outdoor space. It's more rural community, and there was a mechanic that was living there. And the mechanic was quite agitated, so the staff got it in their heads that he really needed to be close to a car. So they worked with a local car yard and brought in an old van that was no longer functional. They took the hood off of the van, and he would go out there and tinker all day long. And he would just go out, and he'd come back in. And then the staff got the idea that this was like a great activity. So they involved the rest of the residents in car washes and in doing all sorts of things. So to this day, that van sits there. They're looking like a driveway at the edge of somebody's house. I mean, if you lived in an apartment building, that wouldn't be your view, but if you lived in a house, that would be your view. And so what they've done is deeply reflect the needs of the community and the people that are living there. But you need the flexibility in the space and the ability to access it in order to be able to think creatively. Because if you're going to meet people where they're at, you need to be able to design for that. And design for the future as well. I have other examples, but
just to build on what you were saying, I think building a relationship, which is, I understand, difficult, but maybe somehow in our own regulatory system, we could set up that there is a necessity to build a relationship between architect and home. I'll just give a quick example. The day my mom passed away, we had to wheel everything out, and a new director of care came in, and because two residents had fallen and died, she decided that no furnishing could be anywhere in the home, which is essentially where it humanizes the space, but it also is where families can come and be part of the home. But her feeling was that was the way to protect the residents, and to Mike's point earlier, off mic, I think, was the reason I knew those residents, and they were struggling with mental health and search for meaning, and it wasn't the furniture that was the problem for them, right? And dehumanizing the space further was going to be a problem. And a lot of their rooms, this is a questionable brag, but I essentially tried to create a room for my mom that she was at a point where she wasn't experiencing the room, but the people who came into it were. And a couple of the staff were saying, oh, I love coming into this room. I feel so relaxed. And they started to notice the information about my mom and ask questions about her, and she became their mother, their grandmother, because they felt humanized, and so she was humanized. And there's a place for us to build a relationship, I think, with the homes, to consistently be present and helping maybe the residents develop their rooms a bit or develop the floor, just as a way to keep our presence involved. And we're learning, but we're also supporting the care from that perspective. And it would give us that access to information, right? Is it working? Is it not working? And we would start to understand maybe more how people are moving through these spaces, because often I see long-term care where every floor is the same, but the needs of the people, and you were speaking to, I met a younger woman in my mom's last long-term care, and she was about 45, I think. Her needs were very different than the other people on the floor, and the other people on other floors, their needs were very different, but everything looked the same and worked the same. So I think we need to sort of be inside the facilities building those relationships. I'm not sure how you could, I mean, it should be fairly done, so we're paid, but getting at changing the structure of our relationships and the structure of how those projects are maybe thought about, that they're thought about in terms of a process, more temporally, as opposed to like a fixed start and stop date or something of that nature.
I think part of it is the whole ecosystem too, right? It's come up a couple times now. The staff is also a big part of this, right? The staff is a huge part of this. If they're not happy to be there, that's part of the demise of the whole relationship, right? So when you look at this as an ecosystem, it's right from the ministry all the way down to people working in the facility. Offices should have windows. There should be staff rooms. Maybe they should have a garden of their own to go out and relax. It's a tough job. There's no question about it, right? It's not for the faint of heart in a lot of ways, but you can make relationships. It's a place to live, right? It's a place of friendship. It's a place of joy. I think it was said earlier, and it should be that. So, you know, that whole ecosystem has to come from the top. Well, maybe not from the top down. Maybe it is from the bottom up, right? But it's linking all those pieces together. And I think, you know, I look at the audience and the creative minds that are in the audience, and on the panel, and I go, how come this can't happen, right? How come this can't happen? And maybe it's just because we get so wound up in our own busy lives on a daily basis. You get to the end of the day, you're tired. Okay, well, now it's Thursday. Now it's Friday. Hey, the weekend. Woo-hoo. And then you start up again on Monday. But I'd go out on a limb and say most of us, it's a 7-day week most of the time. And you're kind of going right through the whole thing. But when you're designing, and we found it really encouraging working with the First Nations, because I believe they have a better view of life. I just fundamentally believe that. They want to care for their elders. They want to care for the community, and it's a mini ecosystem in a larger ecosystem, and it's all put together. Like, we had a community consultation plan for last night, and they postponed it because there was an incident in the community. Shut down the entire community. That's just the kind of people that they are, right? They're all there to support one another. And you could see it in the staff in the homes, in the Wikwimacong home especially. We're also working on one in Batchewana, and that's a bit different, unique in its own way, because the operator is different. So again, it's that ecosystem. But taking care of the staff is also an important piece as well. Who's going to be working in that home on a daily basis? How are they entering the home? How are they exiting the home? If they need a moment, you know, is it a resident room that's designed differently that they want to hang out in? It could be a lot of things, right? So
we'll start off with one of the questions that we touched on, because it might be different for everyone in this room, and thinking about what is important for ourselves and for other people at the end of our lives. What are kind of the values and priorities? Things like safety, community, social lives came up quite a few times. Family, comfort. So is there anyone that wants to jump in with a thought, something that'd be important to them or their group?
Hi there. What would be important to me is the dividend that I would get as a shareholder.
So live in a profit-driven nursing home, okay. Anyone else? What's an important thing? You know, there's one down here.
Thank you. We had talked earlier about policies, and some policies are not so good as others. And how do we change those? And how do we review them? And are there any mechanisms set in place?
Anyone else in terms of like, what do you envision is important for you in the final stages of your life? Do you want family nearby? Do you want to have friends nearby? Do you want to be comfortable?
We've learned a lot from Indigenous cultures about the respect that everybody has for their elders. And I think, I don't know how we do it, but it is we're begging the question, how do we create that in cultures that don't have that tradition? Because I think if you've got respect and love, then possibly more policy, money follows from that. But we do not have a culture that respects the elders. We've got a terrible ageism problem.
I think you make a good point. Maybe Mike, maybe you want to jump in on that with your experience. Any differences in cultures and how that works?
It's a very large question, right? Because it's not just Indigenous culture; it's all cultures, right? And I've always been a firm believer that culture starts in your own home. It doesn't necessarily have to be pushed down on you or everything from, you know, we go to a family reunion and Noni was Italian and my grandfather's Ukrainian. You should have seen the family reunion, right? We had petaha, which is pierogies for you that don't know Ukrainian. We had lasagnas and we had all those things, and I carry those forward, right? You carry them forward. So I'm in the kitchen making a spaghetti sauce like my dad did, that he got the recipe from his noni, and you pull it forward. And I think that when you're meeting with the Indigenous cultures, you listen. I don't walk into those meetings pretending to know everything and you listen to what they have to say. And sometimes it's four conversations later that you actually get. Sometimes the conversation is just, how's the day going? And it's four conversations later that you pick up on different things that they're concerned about. And you listen and you record, and then you have to go back to your notes and you go through. But it's a lot of it is about listening and spending the time. It's spending the time. If you're not willing to spend the time to go to the community and meet with them face to face, don't bother. Right? Video is great, but it's really nothing when you can actually sit there in a sunrise ceremony at 5 a.m. in the morning, watching the sun come up and listening to an elder talk about, and the one that we just went to was fantastic. It was amazing. And you don't pull out a phone, you don't videotape it, you listen and you learn. And you bring those lessons back and you ask questions. They're no different than anybody else. They love to talk too. It's just, how do you talk with them? Right? You're not talking to them, you're talking with them. You're starting a conversation. And I think that's one of the keys to culture in general. But especially with the dealings that we've had with different First Nations communities, it's listening. And sometimes it's just giving time. You don't charge for it. You know, you got to make an extra trip to a job because a contractor didn't finish on time. It's okay. I'm there for you. And that's part of it, right?
Yeah.
Food is a good place to start when we think about culture. And there's a real emphasis in a lot of long-term care facilities on cutting down on expenses. So lots of the large chains in particular are bringing in prepackaged meals. They're doing things in a way that is really meant to standardize. I was just out in Vancouver 2 weeks ago doing field research, and we were at a home that catered to the South Asian population. And there they have five people in the kitchen because all of the food is made from scratch every single day. The place smelled delicious. Like, it was absolutely like amazing walking in. And they have one woman who comes in for 4 hours a day making fresh roti because the seniors were like, you're not giving us frozen roti. This is like foundational to who we are. The same with Italian homes where I've been. You wouldn't dare not serve pasta as part of the meals. So I think that when we're looking at cutting costs and shaving off kitchens and making places that are smaller and, you know, just trying to do these pre-prepared meals, we're actually removing people's dignity at the end of their lives. We're taking away the things that are foundational to what it means to live with community and to be part of community. So I think, like, it's not a simple thing, but it's also not complex. Like, we can get this right, but we have to, like, play it forward and imagine how people can work in a space that's big enough, a kitchen that has enough space to be able to have what they need in order to prepare these kinds of meals.
Bring yourself to the table, right? Bring yourself to the table.
Also add in a more general sense that one of the problems with ageism speaks to a lot of other issues that we have as a society, right? Like, we don't really value the earth, we don't really value children, not in the way that we should. We're at each other's throats half the time, and if we're waiting for that change to come and that wisdom to evolve, and then we design for it, we're not going to get a chance, right? World's on fire. So, just to, you know, I think you guys put it very elegantly about how to foster humanity and beauty in our spaces, but I think what we also have to understand is that we need to force that conversation and force that issue, because we need to be part of changing the thinking so that we can actually start to build in the way we want to and need to as a society. Otherwise, if we're waiting, I don't have a lot of hope for that, but I think we do have a really important role, and people, like, you know, my anecdote before about the other architect, part of that was an anecdote about the fact that that story captured the imagination of the public, that someone in the public saw something that served them in a fundamental way as well. So we have that ability. We just have to nurture it in ourselves, right? In the larger conversations.
The other big issue, or some of the comments that came from some of our consultations, was the issue of bathing. Very, very difficult subject, talking about dignity, especially with First Nations coming from residential school historical issues. So it's, you know, do you want to shower in your own room, or do you go to a bath, right? So you may be able to take a shower, but you don't have that facility in your room, so you're going to a central location. You may not be able to get there, so you're helped to get to a bath on a timeline or when your time is, but it's a really difficult question. And one long-term care facility, we are actually, the operator's open to this. And again, that's having that conversation, talking about policies and things like that. The operator is actually open to at least having 12 rooms out of 96 with private showers, because there will be residents who can operate a private shower. They want a private shower. Slips and falls and safety. We were talking briefly. It comes back to money sometimes with the operators. But if you have a good operating team and you start these conversations early, you can affect change.
Point about safety. When we think about what we want, we put ourselves in the position of, what if I was going to a long-term care home and I was going to live there, or my mother, father? Safety is probably not the first thing we would start with if it's for ourselves. We want familiar things. We might want to bring our dog. We might want to have food that we recognize and that we love and that we've always had. So I think this idea of safety needs and weighed against having options and choices and dignity. So I think that's something that we could think about, guidelines that aren't always really about safety.
It isolates, which is the opposite, right, of safety.
Yes.
Like, if you bring in, I remember a prof of mine said, eyeballs are safety. Cameras are not. Cameras are an indication there's a problem. And I think that, like, to your earlier point, if you're bringing in the community and there's a reason for them to be there, there's more eyeballs, there's more participation, there's sharing the load, which goes back to the ageism issue, is we need to share the responsibility, But to do that, we need to also start to look at how all of the things that are interacting and interrelated start to have to shift and move in order for that to be possible. I mean, you shouldn't have to give up your entire life to be able to care for someone at home, right? It should fall to all of us as some part of a community to engage with that on some level. So,
yeah, and having it all about risk management is probably not the best way to proceed. And, you know, if we were in Australia, we wouldn't even be having a conversation about whether or not we have a shower in every room. It's just a going-in assumption. So questioning the assumptions that we have about what should be done and what ought to be done, I think, is an important part, conversation starter. I saw a hand.
There's a few hands.
Yeah.
So came out of a very good dialogue with these two colleagues to my right. So I'm going to make an observation, pose two-part question, but a pointed one at the end for the panel. One is when we take a stand back. I've always walked on the outside of architecture. I operate the client perspective, not from the professional practice perspective. I've seen 25 years of that. So that sandbox which we find ourselves in as a profession is often more loosely defined than it really is. And when you look back to the core principle of community wellness and dignity, before you start to look at the sandbox, gilded birdcage of long-term care, let's go back to the first question I think you had asked Mike, which was, I think it was Mike or whoever, or Ryan. Do we want to be in long-term care? One hand went up in this room. So putting aside the end location of long-term care discussion for a second, there were two very interesting observations made by both Dr. Daly and Dr. Peters around other models, other cultures. What is that discussion, really not time for the panel now, for independent living in the lead up to long-term care? Because right now, the models of independent living provide people agency. They still have money for other forms of independent living based on the cultural practices, familial practices, economic practices. The more we build that, the more we lessen the burden on long-term care. It is about money at the end of the day, so less demand on long-term care, more focus on independent. But I was curious, there was a missing element. This is the point of question to the panel. We talked about ministry, we talked about finding, we talked about client, and we talked about the user. Where's the city in all of this? In both of these examples I just referred to, the city has a role to play. We talk about choice, we talk about co-location libraries, public schools, nurseries, etc. That's a municipality choice, not a provincial choice, not an OMB decision. What is those progressive models within Canada for that? We've had very good examples out of Kitchener-Waterloo, where granted that's more of a Christian-based area, not very multicultural in that, where there's a good driver for it. But where's the municipality in that for planning, for choice? And where is also the city in terms of the economic model of the trade-offs by saying, happens in Barrie with the YMCA in terms of the Y versus affordable housing versus a private developer. They have a role to play. Where is the city in this? Choice of planning model for choice of program and choice of economic model for I'll give you a 99-year lease and a plot of land if you co-locate it or if you build your 30-story condo, independent living with three stories. That discussion, because that provides agency to people. We shouldn't focus on the ministry or what we do as a profession internally. People, what choices are we saying to the public to say, have you thought about? Because they're in the dark, and they've got choice. That was a long, rambling, perhaps pointed question at the end.
In Ontario, every municipality is required to have a long-term care. So whether that's like the regional municipality or it's the city, as it would be in the city of Toronto, that's an actual requirement. So the cities should be there and they should be at the table. The truth is that we're living longer, and that's the good news, right? So the notion, like what long-term care looked like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, was you would go there maybe for the last 10 years of your lives. But today, you're lucky if that's the last 12 to 16 months of your life. So the length of time that people are spending in long-term care is really protracted. It's not only that we don't have enough beds and we have long waiting lists, but it's also because the people that are going to long-term care are better supported at home for longer, but they also can't get into long-term care. So we do need to think about better supports in terms of home care and independent living. The truth of the matter is, though, that a lot of the options that are available for independent living are in a lot of the people that are in independent living and retirement homes actually should be in long-term care. They've gone to that step because they need long-term care and they can't get in. So then the question is, how do we better provide the kinds of health and social care supports that people need? How do you live in an age-friendly community to get those sorts of supports? I think we're focusing on the buildings and having more beds, and we need to. But the truth is, actually, most people will never go to long-term care. That is that, you know, there's about 10 to 20% of the population that will require it, and you know, getting into long-term care, the needs assessment that you're required to have is very high. And the truth is that the people are there desperately need that level of care. And as my Swedish colleague says, only the best will do. Like, it's not, let's do the minimum for people that need long-term care. In fact, we should approach long-term care knowing that the people that go need it so desperately, and their families need it so desperately. We all in Ontario, all of us in Ontario, ought to be thinking about how we risk share with them to make sure that they can stay in gainful employment, that they can continue in schools, that they're well supported, and that their loved one is secure, happy, and living a joyful and dignified life toward the end. Like, that's the goal, I think, and it behooves us all to make sure that people that need it get it, because none of us want that to happen to any of our neighbors or anyone that we know or love. And that's the truth, and we forget that.
I don't think that the I don't think cities are engaged enough, quite frankly. So when I'm talking about like that, some of that is, they are the decision makers. You're sitting at the table with the chief and council, the operators, they're operating their own home. They're able to say, this land, okay, here's your land, this is where you're gonna build, we own it, it's ours. So I don't think the cities are engaged enough in one sense, because I live in Sudbury, we have planning, we have site plan control, bylaws, permitting, all of those things. Not to say that those are bad things, right? But that process needs to start early, because the process takes time. So for example, when we look at what the ministry did with this funding top-up announcement in November, you were required to submit your schematic design or concept design by February 28th, and then working drawings by March 31st. Well, there's already a gap there, right? So, and that's assuming that the land, you've done a study, let's say, they own the land's there, it's ready for you. Site plan control agreement on a facility, a 96-bed facility, which is somewhere in the order of 72,000 square feet, is going to take time. It's going to take time. So it's that whole process that has to be, they need to be at the table. They need to be at the table early. They need to be partners in some of those developments. Whether they own the facility and they hire the operator, they're managing it, but there are processes. And so working with circumventing rules, they just have a different way of dealing with it. So you move into a city or a municipality or wherever you are, you have to be cognizant of what you're up against, and not up against, sorry, I should use that term, it's what are the challenges and how are you going to get to where you need to go working with, and if you can start those conversations early, I can't emphasize it enough, don't isolate yourself, start a conversation, because if you can meet with your municipality and say, look, we think this is coming down the pipe, even if you think something's coming down the pipe, start the ball rolling, right? Get them on board, talk to them. They've done some neat things with garden suites and the ability now to add a little suite out the back of your home. It's kind of funny because some of these ideas aren't new, they've been around for a long time. My parents built when I was 4 years old, and they gave up the garage and built an in-law suite, and that's where my grandma lived, right beside us. My mom looked after her for as long as she could, and there just came a point where she couldn't do it anymore, mm-hmm. but the help, the process was horrible. I think it's CCRA, you have to call, and they have to do an assessment, and, oh, you know what, she's not ready for a home yet, you got to stay here. You know, my mom was working, my dad was working, we were off in school. I remember, I think Chris or Jeff, Perry may be in the audience, their father, Bob, had come over to the house to borrow a drill and nobody was home. He actually helped pick my grandma off the floor and put her back in a chair. So that's the kind of stuff that can happen. So it's a broken system in a lot of ways.
home care is awesome. Like, I hope I can do that for my mom and dad and things like that. But you can't pretend that you can do it yourself, because there is a level of care that's required.
Yep.
So again, it's a daunting task. It's an important task, but you have to know what you're doing. It's not. So again, coming back to, like, the cities have to be involved. There are a variety of different ways they can be involved. They want to be involved. You just got to talk to them. Right? You got to talk to them. Different cultures have different ways of looking at things. We know a lot of immigration, for example, and gentleman Karsh Singh, who we're working with through Habitat for Humanity, will tell you East Indians coming into town, a lot of it's about home ownership. And, you know, they have people living in, same with First Nations and other cultures, the mom and dad are living in the home. They're all living in one place, right? So you take all these things into account, and how does that work? And then you're going to tear them away from that and put them in a long-term care facility. So a lot of important stuff. It's, I mean, this is days of conversation, not half hours, but it's important.
I just want to touch on a couple of things you said. You're taking them out of their home, putting them in a long-term care facility is probably halfway across town or worse. The facilities in your neighborhood are often inaccessible. Someone had to really fight for my mom to get in at the end of her life because, like you said, we were threatened if you reject the home, you don't get back on the list, right? So, but the other thing I was thinking in terms of the city's involvement and home care, there's a lot that we need to push the city to think about as well. With home care, you're getting people coming in for support, but most of them live far away. They have travel limitations. The people that are organizing them are, well, be careful with my words, but they're organizing them as contractors, but they schedule it in a way that's illogical. So the city, like in our neighborhood, it's a very homogeneous neighborhood, you know, in a lot of ways, morphologically, but also there needs to be a way in a conversation that talks about how do we actually bring people together in all neighborhoods so that we can help each other. Because what we kind of grew a family with the people coming into our home, but the organizers tried to discourage that team, that family network that was growing, by rescheduling and changing things up. And I think the city has a role to play in terms of how it understands transportation, how it understands neighborhoods, how it shapes those spaces, but how it also incorporates many people in the neighborhood and not just sort of isolates people further. But those are conversations we would have to initiate. There was a comment about policy, and I was just wondering, maybe a question for you is, do you see a role for our self-regulation as approaching how policy is getting done? You know, does our self-regulating body have a role in maybe getting to the table on behalf of us to make those conversations happen, either with the city or with the ministry or whoever we think is a necessary partner? Because I live in Ottawa, so, you know, we fall through the cracks, right? Because the city says it's the feds say it's the city, the province doesn't know we exist. Basically, that isolated silo relationship is not working for anybody, right? So we need to, and I think we are pattern makers and we can bring that conversation together, you know, as you say, understand the connections, but we need to be able to maybe force the issue a little bit and present the argument that we need to come to the table as a group and work it out, because there's a lot of moving parts, you know, and we're not going to solve it by just thinking of one, you know, one issue to solve. It has to be solved as a system. And we have to work as a system instead of more like an industry, I think, in order to achieve that.
I think this conversation kind of leads really nicely into that next question about alternative models and things like aging in place and working with the cities to allow for new systems for long-term care. So were there any thoughts either from the panelists and maybe other countries that we can look to, or is there any thoughts from the audience on some alternatives, aging in place, in-law suites, things like that, that we can start to implement a little bit more.
Plain and simple. It's getting involved. Sudbury's just starting a new downtown master planning process, for example. So you don't need to pay to get paid to volunteer your time, right? You donate time, and you get involved. And that you can't. It's like the age old. You don't get mad at who was elected because you didn't vote, right? So if you want to be heard, get out and be heard. And especially to a lot of the young people in the audience, join committees, volunteer. Yeah, it's going to take a bit more time, and yeah, okay, you're not going to be home for dinner every night at 5, but you give up your time, and sometimes that's a weekend. But if you're not willing to give up time, you're not going to affect change, right?
Question over here, or a comment?
Yeah, more of a comment. I think if we're going to talk about aging in place, we have to also raise our own minimum standards for how we build things like just houses and residences, because if the, you know, condo building that we design has, you know, the X minimum number of accessible suites, but all the rest of them are not, and, you know, even Ontario Building Code minimum is not really accessible, then we're just boxing ourselves into a corner because people can't age in place without expensive renovations, which, you know, if you're living in a condo might not even be possible. So like, this is a much more fundamental. There's like several layers before we even get to the long-term care facility of how we build our buildings and how I think we should be, you know, regulating ourselves as a profession and, you know, contributing to policy that we're just not doing at this point.
Another thought over here, or question over here.
It tied a little bit to the earlier discussion about culture in respect to elders. And I think it's, you know, we can talk about structure and we can talk about planning and city involvement and committees. And that is all structure and, in a way, tactical strategies to put things in place. But I think that the gentleman there, and I think Nicole also dealt with it a little bit, touched upon it, is ageism. Because if we go to the root of the problem, we discount our elders. I mean, when we even have to discuss aging in place and being allowed for older adults to remain within the community where they've lived all their lives, I mean, just that conversation should be a red flag that we're advocating for them to stay in place. If we look back into housing history, it's only in the past, 50 years or so that we've felt that it's a great solution to take this cohort of older generation and put them, you know, in a different place. And here we are in a plenary that I think it touches upon the ethos of the conference. And as professionals that we could affect some change, we still refer to these places as, well, there's a shortfall of beds. So that adds to the discounting. There's not a shortfall of beds. There's a shortfall of places where people can safely and securely, without being surveilled, right, can come and spend the last months of their lives. So, you know, there have been other sectors of the population that have been incredibly well organized in terms of advocating for their rights, advocating for equality of presence, equality of voice, equality of rights. And they're very well organized, and they have done an amazing job in asserting their rights to be treated as equals. And I think that the same level of advocacy, and hopefully it starts with our profession, it needs to happen for, we're all heading towards aging, where we're living longer lives. And I think that we are designing spaces. Someone said, I'm not sure from the public or from the planner group, we are designing for ourselves. I mean, these are permanent buildings that are going to see life 15, 20 years, very difficult to retrofit. And we are designing for ourselves. And there is an incredible market opportunity because of the demographics. But that also, I think, comes with a huge responsibility from our profession to be stewards of better environments, of creating places for aging. And I think it starts with us. When I have the opportunity to work with different firms, and I hear members of our profession say, well, I know architects, some architects are all about the views and light and stuff. I'm here to make my client money. So it really, we can look at the ministry as being at fault. We can look at cities and municipalities for being relaxed and not proactive enough. But I think it's also a hard question for us as a profession. What kind of stewards are we in terms of creating better places for aging and really creating a different language, even amongst ourselves, that we're not designing beds, we're not designing 40-door complexes. We're designing places where actual people are going to live.
Yeah.
People, not users.
Sorry, I just wonder though, if we've kind of organized our society around commodification of the individual from the day they're born and looking at them as leading productive lives, productive in someone's terms, but maybe not productive in terms of the discussion we're having here. I see my mother's 97, she's in a facility in Cambridge, so I'm being introduced to the world of long-term care over the course of the months. But it doesn't surprise me that we've commodified the elderly if we've commodified the young and we've commodified everyone else of every age in between. So in some ways, this discussion about end of life, for me, is the logical consequence of how we've organized the rest of it. I'm sorry.
Well, so then the question is, how do we collectivize it again? Because in order for it not to be a commodity, for us to not provide assembly line care, for us to care about individuals, for us to personalize it, for us to understand that aging is not just a downward slope, but it's a series of steps, and that it's a communal experience, we need to change the conversation, and we need to think more broadly about how we are all involved in the aging process. We need to think about universal design so that it meets the needs of people as they age, not just older people, right? So we all have different mobility needs as we age. Eyes change, people are born needing different mobility aids. So these kinds of concepts like that are more universal, that bring more people into the conversation, I think could help to change how we think about things.
It could be also to do with how we educate architects. Like I teach architecture studios where the students design long-term care. And trying to see how what their ideas are for health promoting architecture, because that's their absolute starting point, is we need to make this, how do we make this health promoting for people? So they're designing in a different way, and it's not really matching their experience when I take them to a long-term care home, and they're looking for the evidence of the health-promoting architecture, which they're sure is in there somewhere. But it's really not our priority, I would argue, with current long-term care design. I don't really see how it's designed to promote people's physical and spiritual and mental health. I think it could be. But I wonder if anyone here who went to architecture school ever did a long-term care home as a final design project. It's not a common, it's slightly unusual as a project, especially maybe even a renovation of a long-term care home would be even harder or even less common. So what are we teaching architects and training them to become practitioners and professionals? And I think it's a lot of its values and stewardship and advocacy. So I hope that the profession can show leadership in this area, and we can try to bring that through the schools too.
Some of it too is, I understood the comment. It's about everything that we do all the time. We don't have to go to the ministry and make a big change. It's designing that next building. It's designing that next home. It's designing that next residence. It doesn't necessarily have to be meetings with the city and the ministry and all these things, right? It can be in the choices that we make, and how we interpret our clients' needs and wants. Right? So.
We're running out of time. I see some people sneaking out for the next session, so we'll just have to wrap it up here. Hopefully everyone came away with a new perspective and they can feel inspired to make some changes in their own communities.
Just one quick thing, Ryan. One idea I had at the break, and maybe this is where the OAA can help us, is instead of submitting designs for awards, maybe it's just an interim publication or web presentation where we just submit designs and they publish them. You know, share different ideas, right? That's another way of doing it. Not because if you don't submit it, no one knows what you've done. So just being connected, right?
So I'd like to thank everyone for coming. We can give a round of applause to our guests up here. Thank you. Thanks again to the OAA for putting this together, and I'm supposed to give a shout out to the sponsors, Graphisoft. They supplied the bags that you see on your chairs, and Hub supplied the session today, and please visit all the sponsors in the conference center. Thanks.